redistricting committee.
Testing, testing.
Call the committee to order. Representative Podolsky, if you'd like to welcome everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to welcome the redistricting committee, in particular Chairman Paulson, for coming to Winona today. This is a rather major event. It happens once only every 10 years as a result of the census that was done in 2000. So these events are rare. This committee is only constituted by the House and the Senate on that 10-year cycle. And I know that we have members of the City Council here tonight. I don't see the mayor, but he may be here. And we have a couple of City Council people. We have people from the county. And we'll probably have some school board members. For the committee, this chamber is now used by the City Council, by the county, who will meet here at 7 o'clock, and also by our school board. So this is a multi-use chamber. And with that, I think, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back over to you, and we can perhaps introduce the members of the committee.
That's great. And Representative Podolsky, I do want to thank you for hosting this meeting today in Winona. And right before we have members introduce themselves, I will just quickly take care of some routine committee business. And first, maybe Representative Gray, if we move the minutes of the February 13th meeting, the fifth meeting of the redistricting committee.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion on that motion? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Next, we have before us the minutes of the sixth meeting of the redistricting committee from February 20th. Representative Mariani, that...
Mr. Chair, I would move those minutes.
Any discussion on the motion? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. I would like to have members of the committee introduce themselves, but first I do want to thank members for taking the time once again to travel to Greater Minnesota to be with us today. Members have a busy day during session at the Capitol, attending committee meetings in the morning and return later this evening for additional meetings tomorrow morning as well. I want to thank the staff for taking the time to set up today's proceedings here in Winona. And I want to thank all members of the audience, especially looks like the students who came as well. We hope you're able to learn something about the redistricting process, and more importantly, we hope to learn from you and really to gain your input. And with that, I'll introduce myself real quickly. I'm Eric Paulson, and I represent Eden Prairie, most of Eden Prairie, and portions of Edina in the Twin Cities, and I'm in my fourth term currently and chairing the redistricting committee. Representative Mariani, if you want to begin on that side.
Sure. My name is Carlos Mariani Rosa. I'm currently serving in my sixth term, and I represent downtown St. Paul, the west side and west side of the neighborhoods of St. Paul. And it's been my privilege to have served with Gene Podolsky for 11 years now. Gene's a pretty good rep. I've learned quite a bit from him. I also want to say it's been a long time since I've been in Winona. And I've forgotten how pretty it is. This is really a pretty part of the state. It's a privilege to be here.
I'm Representative Marty Seifert. I'm also a member of the redistricting committee for the first time here. It's a privilege to be on this committee and a privilege to be in Winona. I represent District 21E, which is in the southwestern part of the state. If you look at the map over there, it'd be the it looks like a bird that got hit in the beak from the bottom side. It's the second district up from the southwest corner of the state. My part of the state is losing population probably more than any other part of the state in the western and southwestern portions of the state. And it's a privilege to be here today. I'm from Marshall.
My name is Greg Pepin. I'm a staff person, a redistricting analyst for the committee.
Hi, I'm Representative Michelle Riffenberg. I'm Vice Chairman of the Redistricting Committee. I'm from District 32B, so it's good to be home in the middle of the week, and I think Senate District 32 is well represented on this committee.
Good afternoon. I'm Brenda Boudreau. I represent District 25B, which is the southern portion of Rice and LeSueur counties, and I live in Faribault, and I'm also beginning my fourth term.
Good evening. My name is Frederick Gray, State Representative in District 58B, which is North Minneapolis, including part of downtown and the Target Center here in Timberwolves Band. I would like to echo the comments of Representative Mariani and say that this is an absolutely beautiful city. We had a chance to ride around as we were trying to find the city hall, and got a good chance to look at the city, and great place to live. Thank you for the invitation.
Just to follow up on that, Representative Pawlowski gave Representative Seifert and myself a tour of the city as well, and stopped and saw some, as we drove down 61, saw some bald eagles. We were along the open water, so that was kind of fun to see as well. As Representative Pawlowski mentioned, the committee is really here in Winona tonight on the third of several trips to greater Minnesota to describe the redistricting process, to solicit your input and answer any questions that you might have. In preparation of tonight's meeting, the committee notified close to 70 various elected officials, city clerks, and county auditors, sent news releases out to over 18 newspapers in the area, southwestern Minnesota, notified 10 different radio stations and 3 television stations in the listening area. This hearing is informal, so all members of the audience know, and we do invite your questions at any time. Because we're taping the meeting, we ask that you try to speak loudly with the taping system here so we can pick up that for the microphone. Please feel free to raise your hand and come forward if you do have a question or have some input to be recognized. I do want to begin by letting everyone know that the goal of the committee is to develop a fair redistricting plan, one that will encompass the 134 House districts in the state, the 67 Senate districts in the state, as well as the 8 U.S. congressional districts in Minnesota. And we want to recognize the population and the demographic shifts and changes that have occurred in the state over the last 10 years, and that gives minority groups the opportunity for representation. I would like to just take a couple of minutes to give some brief remarks on the process itself. Committee members have heard this several times before, but I think it's a particular benefit to members of the audience. The United States Constitution does stipulate, as Representative Pawlowski mentioned earlier, that every 10 years, all 50 state legislatures must redraw their legislative and congressional districts. This is based on the new population figures provided by the U.S. Census Bureau. So every 10 years, the boundaries for the state representatives and senators, as well as for U.S. Congress, are redrawn to accommodate the changes in population. We've begun this process in Minnesota now, both the House, or I should say we've had several meetings already with the goal of passing a bill this year. We're studying the history of redistricting here in Minnesota, the population shifts in the state since 1990, and we're learning how to use the data from the U.S. Census Bureau and the mapping software as well. As with any other bill in the legislative process, both the House and the Senate will develop redistricting plans, and the chances are those plans could be very well very different. The challenge comes in melding the two plans together, one that would pass both the House and the Senate, and then be presented to the governor for signature as any other bill to become law. The governor, so members of the audience are aware, has also become involved in the redistricting process by forming a 10-member citizen advisory commission in order to get input on redistricting as well. That commission is meeting weekly in St. Paul. The Senate Redistricting Committee had its first meeting this past Monday and has begun their process. Much of what we do is required by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Federal Voting Rights Act, and the Minnesota Constitution and state statutes. There are many factors that do play a role in developing a fair redistricting plan with the ultimate goal of having the legislative and congressional districts drawn fairly to represent all Minnesotans. Districts should be substantially equal in population. Prior to the 1960s, this was not the case. Districts were not equal in size. But after the U.S. Supreme Court cases, Baker versus Carr and Reynolds versus Sims, population equality really became a requirement. For congressional districts, this means now we're required to go down to the exact person, the 0% deviation. For legislative districts, it could be a 1% plus or minus 1% deviation, for instance. Districts also need to be made up of convenient, contiguous territory. It's according to Article 4, Section 3 of the Minnesota Constitution. So all precincts in any given district must be connected geographically. So districts cannot have separate other districts disconnecting. They have to physically be connected. As much as possible, districts should be compact and not meander in unusual shapes through different cities or counties. And another consideration is certainly preserving communities of interest where that is practical. And we also want to make sure that we'll be working to prevent the dilution of any voting strength of racial or language minority populations, and in cases where possible, to increase the probability that members of the minority will be elected. Again, the ultimate goal is to have both legislative and congressional boundaries that are drawn to fairly represent all Minnesotans and recognize the demographic and population shifts that have occurred in Minnesota. So with that, I want to then thank members of the audience for attending. There is a sign-up sheet for everyone to sign in, if you could please do that. There are some handouts that have been made available from the Secretary of State's office and the State Demographer's office that they may touch on upon their presentations. I think you'll find of interest. And feel free to informally walk up and look at the maps that have been brought along as well. You may find that of interest. So with that, I think we'll proceed and have a presentation given to us by the State Demographer, Mr. Gillespie. If you're going to take just a minute to bring the projector forward. Representative Gray, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify something. If I understood you, you were saying that the deviation for legislative districts is 1%. I thought it was 5%. Is that, am I mistaken?
No, Representative Gray, I just mentioned that could be a standard, plus or minus 1%.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, federal case law said plus or minus 5%.
Thank you.
Yep. Mr. Westby, whenever everything's ready, you can proceed. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Tom Gillespie. Do I need to use my
time? We'll just slide that.
The slide that can take recorder. There is a handout available on the table that will include all of the graphics I will show. And of course, please feel free to contact us at any time for further information. We have, at this time, the first results from the 2000 census. We only have one number per state, and that is the total state resident population. The total resident state population counted in the 2000 census to be used for redistricting purposes is 4,919,479. And that'll be the number used as the basis for the size of legislative congressional districts. The Census Bureau also counted some people under certain circumstances living abroad, resident population or Minnesota population living abroad, and that number was 6,191, and that added to the resident population of the state, gave us a total population of the state to be used for congressional reapportionment. Now, this is a good time probably to distinguish between two words, reapportionment and redistricting. Reapportionment is something that is called for in the U.S. Constitution, is to divide the House of U.S. House of Representatives among the various states according to their population. That is done once every 10 years. Minnesota, according to the formula, continues to have 8 congressional seats. Our neighbor to the east, Wisconsin, actually lost a seat this reapportionment and will have only 8 congressional seats when they did have 9. The other term, redistricting, is what the committee is concerned with, is actually redrawing the districts of the congressional districts, I'll be looking two ways at once. The congressional districts, the state House of Representatives districts, and the state Senate districts. Minnesota last decade gained substantial amounts of population and gained population at a substantially faster rate than we did during the 70s or the 1980s. This was largely due to population, to people moving into the state from other parts of the nation, and to a lesser extent from other parts of the world. And as a result, during the decade, Minnesota gained, according to the census, 12.4%. That is only slightly slower than the approximate 13% gain for the entire nation. And the critical issue here is, and the issue throughout this discussion, since there are a fixed number of congressional seats, and unless the legislature changes the number of legislative seats, we have a fixed number of legislative seats to divide up among the various areas of the state according to population. And the critical issue is the growth of any particular area relative to the total area. Minnesota grew at approximately the same rate as the nation. We keep our 8 congressional seats. Wisconsin, which grew by nearly 10%, which is a fairly rapid pace of growth, still grew slower than the nation as a whole, and therefore lost a congressional seat. Some basic numbers for Minnesota redistricting is that we have 8 congressional seats, that each of our 8 congressional seats will on average have 614,935 people. That, of course, is up 12.4% from the 1990 number of 546,958, which means that now congressmen will need to, our congressional representatives will need to represent a larger population. Then each of the 134 state house seats will represent 36,713, an increase of approximately 4,000 people over the number in after the 1990 redistricting. Just a background on why Minnesota grows, or how we divide growth up, or how it's divided up. Each year, approximately 60,000 babies are born in Minnesota. Approximately 30,000 people die in Minnesota. That gives us a natural increase of approximately 30,000 people each year. In addition to that, 80 to 90,000 people move into Minnesota each year. That's the rate that we are experiencing right now. Approximately 70 to 80,000 people move out of Minnesota for the last decade. In fact, a little bit over a decade, we've had more people move in to Minnesota than move out. And an additional 5 to 8,000 people move to Minnesota from other parts of the world, immigrate from other nations of the world. And our growth rate is a little bit more than 1%, a little over 1% per year. Nearly half of our growth last decade was due to migration, people moving in from other parts of the nation and other parts of the world. Our total increase due to migration was nearly 252,000 people. Our natural increase, the excess of births over deaths, was nearly 293,000 people. Nearly half of our interstate migrants come from 5 states: Wisconsin, California, North Dakota, Illinois, and Texas. Within the state, and again, I might direct you to the maps that are available that show the counties of the state according to their change by from 1990 to 99, and then focus on the southeast corner of the state by city and township. And then the other map shows how the legislative districts, according to the estimates that we have right now, how the legislative districts compare versus that average, that equal size population. During the 1990s, most of the growth in Minnesota occurred in the Twin City suburban ring, that surrounds Minneapolis and St. Paul, and there we saw a growth of over 18.5% and nearly, we're approaching half of the population living in that suburban ring surrounding the Twin Cities. That growth is similar to, but only slightly slower than the growth that we saw during the 80s in the same area. The biggest change from the 1980s into the 1990s was the growth, the resurgent growth in the rest of the state. Minneapolis and St. Paul continue to either experience a little change or a slight decline, but the rest of the state began to show more growth, increasing by a little over 4% during the decade. The main growth axis in the state runs from southeastern Minnesota up through the Twin Cities and St. Cloud, up to the northern, north central portion of the state into Canada. Surrounding that is an area of slower growth, but still mostly growth. And then in the southwest and western portions in particular, we find many counties that have experienced long-term population decline as oftentimes due to long-term migration, out-migration of young people when they graduate from high school. Many young people will seek a higher education or opportunities in larger cities and move out of the counties, and that has been true for a very long time in southeastern or southwestern and western Minnesota. Focusing in on the district and the map of legislative district deviations is perhaps a little bit more clear than this map, but the basic the basic story for legislative districts in southeastern Minnesota is that the districts that contain the city of Rochester and immediately surrounding Rochester are a little bit larger than the average size of the district statewide, and puts in to get a bit smaller. The districts in much of the rest of southeastern Minnesota could stand to get a bit larger, although some of them are not that tremendously different from potential target ranges of variation. The districts 27A and 27B that include Albert Lea and Austin are the districts that will probably see the greatest change, since these are districts that have grown slower than or even lost population and will need to get substantially larger. Overall in the state, and again, even though the colors are changed, the map on the wall basically reflects again this change that we have the donut effect in the Twin Cities, which is the insert map on the right, which shows the rapidly growing suburban ring, the legislative districts in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the entering suburbs will need to get larger. The districts in the suburban ring will need to get smaller, and the districts in much of the rest of the state will need to get larger to bring them into line with that average size. Overall, the basic shift that we expect to see based upon the estimates that we have made is the shift of approximately 5 districts into the suburban ring, just simply based upon population, a loss of approximately 2 seats in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and approximately 3 seats in the rest of Minnesota. That is a similar shift to what we saw in the 1980s, but not as dramatic, where the shift was larger. The timing that we are waiting right now to get the final data from the 2000 census, and that should come, well, it has to come before April 1st, and it should. We're expecting that sometime after about the middle of March, and at that time, we will have the final data and be prepared to provide the committee with the materials for its task.
Does that conclude the presentation?
That concludes, yes, sir. Concludes the presentation.
Do we have any questions, Mr. Gillespie? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're in a, on the way up here, Representative Gray and I rode up the elevator with a student from Winona State. And I understand there's a number of students here from the local colleges observing the hearing. My question is, has to do with student bodies in some of these towns. We have, you know, colleges, universities spread around the state. How do student populations, first of all, do they factor in, do they count? What are the rules that we know about in terms of where do we count students? And how have they factored into your knowledge in terms of growth or lack of growth in places like Winona?
Chairman, Mr. Gillespie. Representative Mariano Rosa. Walking away from the mic here. The Census Bureau counts people according to their normal place of residence, and for college age students, that would be where they are going to school and where they are living at the time. So for college age students, if you're going to Winona, you would be counted here unless you're living with your parents or living in an apartment off campus. Then you would be counted according to your place of residence. If you are in the dorm, you will be counted according to your dorm residence. That is not true for pre-college age, for secondary and primary age students who are going to school away from home. They are counted back to the residence of their parents. But for college age students, the Census Bureau counts them according to where they're going to school. So in that case, the university has a rather large impact on the population.
I believe we have Robin Anthony with us from the Secretary of State's office, and we have several local elected officials in the audience. I know the mayor of Winona, I believe, is here, and superintendent of schools and some other local officials, and they may have some specific questions about the timeline process that I think Ms. Anthony can answer those questions as well. And the county auditors as well may have questions. So, you know, Ms. Anthony, I believe the microphone is supposed to project a large sound to the small recording system I have right here. So if it's okay with you, if you could maybe stand where Mr. Gillespie was and use that microphone, and at least you're closer to the microphone. So just identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robin Anthony. I work for the Secretary of State's office. I'm the election administrator there. And happy to be here, and I will too echo the beautiful view traveling down south. I spent a couple of years in La Crosse, Wisconsin, so I had the opportunity to travel down 61 quite often, and it's absolutely beautiful. You are very, very lucky to live here. What I'm here to talk a little bit about today is the Secretary of State's role in redistricting. And for those of you that have not picked them up yet, there are handouts over there with regards to time, an overview of resources and the timetable with some dates that I'll be talking about here in just a few moments. When the legislature completes the redistricting in March of 2002, that's when our work really begins at the local level and through the Secretary of State's office. After the enactment of redistricting, the Legislative Coordinating Commission provides the Secretary of State's office with a plan, the redistricting plan. Our office is then responsible to provide counties with their portions of the plans. The counties then are responsible to provide their municipalities municipalities with their portion of the plans. We also will provide copies of the plan and maps to the public at the cost of production at any time that they so wish. The timeframe of going back to the plan, our office is also responsible to clean up the plan. If there are territories which were omitted from the plan, removing duplicate occurrences of the same territory and resolving ambiguous boundary descriptions. And then a copy of the correction shall be provided to the affected county auditor, candidates, and municipal clerks. And then our office will also recommend, if need be, to the legislature any technical corrections to the plan as we start to observe it more closely. The time frame is quite short, and that seems to be of concern to local government officials. 60 days after the legislative redistricting, or 19 weeks prior to the primary, whichever comes first, local government begins drawing boundaries for wards and precincts. So the plan comes out by March of 2002, we hope, perhaps sooner. By April 30th of 2002, all the wards and precincts must be drawn. County commissioners and school districts that elect members from election districts must be redrawn within 80 days after the legislative redistricting. So it's 60 days and then 80 days. In the meantime, there's a lot to do. The voters' records will change, not all of them, but a good portion of them. Precincts may be added, deleted, polling places may change, and that's sometimes a logistical challenge for municipal clerks. We must make these changes then in the statewide voter registration system, which is the hub database that holds all the voter records in the state of Minnesota. And our office then will provide trainings to the county auditors who tap into the database and maintain their office records and oversee the entire process of this. Candidate filing begins in July, and so you can see it's really a very, very tight time frame. You get the plan in March, you gotta have the ward precincts drawn the end of April, and then candidates start to file in July. You got a short month to be able to update all the voter records. By July 11th, that is the last day to post the notice to the public of new precinct boundaries, and by August 15th, all voters must be notified via the mail where they need to be going to the polling place for the primary election. What our office will be doing to assist local governments, one of the things we'll be doing starting tomorrow morning at 9:30, we've established a redistricting working group, and you have the House Committee redistricting and the Senate Committee redistricting, and you have the Governor's Task Force, and now you'll have the Secretary of State's redistricting working group. We plan to make sure that we're communicating with all the other entities and we're hearing what they're doing so that we're all on the same page, if you will. The working group that we've established consists of county auditors, city clerks, township clerks, school district clerks, the Township Association, the Minnesota League of Minnesota Cities, the County Association and School Board Association, so we're pretty well represented. In addition to that, by law, our office is mandated to hold conferences for the 3,200 municipal clerks and the 87 county auditors. And we'll be doing that the week of July 23rd. We'll be holding, I think it's up to 7 conferences now. We'll be traveling throughout the state of Minnesota holding these conferences, which will be really nice because what we're expecting is that the county auditors will be going to the same conference that all of their municipal clerks will be going to so that they can work together and hear the same message that will be provided. Right now, what can local government do? Being here is a good step. Listening to what's going on at the House and Senate is a good step. Learning as much as possible about the redistricting. Get to know someone that's been through one. So that's how you can find out how old someone is. You just ask them, how many times have you been through this? And you go, 10, 20, 30. So that's quite a little hint there for you. Establish a committee or working group, and I would encourage you to make sure that you have someone from your legal staff on there, as well as a technical staff person who can understand more of the technical, the map issues, the GIS issues, those types of things. Begin to prepare an outline of the process you're going to use and define who's going to be doing what. You need to be obtaining maps from your local government area and associated census population data, and be prepared to move in a very, very short time frame. That's why you want to do this pre-planning ahead of time, so you kind of have your ducks in a row, and when you get the numbers, you're ready to go. Our office will also have a redistricting menu selection on our web page. We have a real nice web page. The web page address is www.sos.state.nn.us, and it's also on the bottom of the handout. That's all I have to share. If you have questions, glad to take them.
Thank you, Ms. Anthony. Any members have any questions of Ms. Anthony?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Pulaski.
Ms. Anthony and Marshall, you didn't tell the local units of government what their deviation might be when they draw their lines. Could you just go over that again? We discussed it for the congressional and for the legislature. So
talking about the county commissioners?
County commissioners, yes.
Okay.
Ms. Anthony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Volsky, I am prepared. I knew you were going to ask this question. So, 375.025 subdivision 4, it is 5%, and that had changed perhaps since the last time. I also have here an opinion from the Attorney General's office that was provided in 1981. Our office still views this to be somewhat unclear, and our legal counsel will be taking a look at this to see if we need to get another opinion from the Attorney General's office. So that's really what the status is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Chair. Ms. Anthony, thank you. I appreciate that. I think they do too. And just for the sake of your observation, do we have anyone in here who's been through redistricting before? At the local level, we do have a couple of survivors.
Two hands.
So we'll be looking forward for input from both of them. So thank you.
And Ms. Anthony, is the 5% deviation, is it plus or minus 5%?
Yes.
Plus or minus 5%. Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Anthony, if we have county commissioner, let's just take Winona County for an example. If we have county commissioner seats that need to be redistricted because perhaps Winona grew, but St. Charles and some of those little towns outside of Winona did not, generally we leave that up to the county commissioners on their own to figure that out. So if they have to, I mean, you talked about survivors, if someone has to get voted off the island, who figures out who gets redistricted in with who? If you have, I don't know if Representative Pulaski, you represent Riffenberg, no, how many, we have five county commissioners, if it's like all but three of the other counties or basically the metro plus St. Louis County. Are there three people in Winona and then two rural people? Is that what the mix is right now?
Representative Pulaski? I think it depends on how you ask them the question. So, but I would be interested if we could get the two county people who are here, if they can give us an observation on how that might change. They've already, I assume, taken a look at the numbers, and they might be able to give us an indication of how that might change, or where those shifts occur, given the maps that are here.
Ms. Anthony?
Mr. Chair, it is up to the county. It is up to the county commissioners. And that's something that will be their task to answer that part of your question.
Mr. Chair, the legislature is not involved whatsoever. Other than setting the deviation number, we just basically turn over to the counties and say, good luck, figure this out.
Ms. Anthony.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, you say, good luck, and provide as much assistance as possible.
Okay, is there anyone from the audience who cares from the counties, for instance, who would like to follow up on that and give some advice or some input or ask a question of Ms. Anthony or others? Don't be shy. And as you're thinking, if there are any other members of the audience who'd like to come forward to provide informally some advice or input on how lines should be drawn, how counties should be, yeah, please come forward. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon. I'm Jerry Miller, Mayor of the City of Winona, and I welcome you all here.
Thank you for having us.
My main concern about the city is how you really do, and it was a good question, how you really do count the college students and university students, because, you know, we have a high population of students that live off campus, and, you know, it's hard to get them all at one time. You know, it's a fluid population sometimes, and depending on when you take the census, what time of the year of that, I think it's a hard thing to do, and maybe you ought to zero in more on the schools themselves. I'm sure Winona State has a record of every student, and the ones that live in Winona naturally would probably be counted somewhere else. But the ones that don't live in Winona, the school should have a record of that. Because to me, it would be pretty hard to catch them all. And that's, you know, that's pretty important to the city of Winona, because approximately one-third of our population is students, are our students. And it is a formidable part, and this is a very important thing to us, that every person gets counted, not only on the state level, but on the federal level also, as far as funding and all that. So I would like to have or make that suggestion, that you try to figure out the best way to make sure that all the students are counted.
Representative Seifert?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this might be for Mr. Gillespie, and I know we perhaps have covered this before, but when are the people counted? For example, Winona, I'm guessing you'd rather have people counted in April before the students leave to go back to Minneapolis, the suburbs, whatever. If they're counting people in June, your dorms are almost emptied, your apartments are more vacant, or would that be a correct analysis, Mr. Mayor?
I think you might want to do it the reversal. You might want to do it in the beginning of the school year, because I think there's some shrinkage, maybe.
Maximize.
You know, I really don't know.
The risk of looking
I do know that it's got to be hard to pick them all up. Like I said, that's important to us, because each student still demands the same services that, you know, that we offer, and our funding is based, you know, a lot of things on how many people.
Mr. Mayor, I appreciate those comments. Obviously, we don't have anyone from the Census Bureau here, but maybe Mr. Gillespie can just give some comments in terms of how the census, the time frame of when they collect that information, just so everyone's aware.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, Mayor, this, of course, is national policy, and with the Census Bureau following a policy that they have engaged in for several decades. The census is taken in, the official census day is April Fool's Day of the year ending in zero, April 1st. And some people find that really amusing, April Fool's Day. But in reality, the census forms were mailed out sometime in advance, starting in early March, and were filled out during that time, and a follow-up began in May to make sure that people had returned. Now, I had a son in college actually who worked on the census at another college, and just to illustrate how these things can sometimes happen, he was in an apartment with four other people, and he was actually working on the census, and they got the census form, and they filled it out as a group, and thought they had mailed it back. And about 2 months later, it was found under a pile of stuff, which they did eventually get it in. But the Census Bureau does make every effort to follow up. We have also been asked to do some review of census of the early census results, and part of that review includes our annual gathering of information from every facility, every organization in the state, which includes all nursing homes and hospitals, but it also includes all colleges and universities, their dorm population and their total student population. And so we try to watch to make sure as best we can that, that there's not a huge difference between what we're expecting and what you should be counted at. But the count is as of April 1st of the year zero.
Would you like to come forward and identify yourself?
Thank you. I'm Eric Lawrence, Superintendent of Schools. And again, thank you for having me. We appreciate the opportunity to address the committee and also the person from the Secretary of State's office. My question is directed to Ms. Anthony. As a school, you can elect 5 of our 7 members by precincts. We have to go through a redistricting process also. When will we have our figures, school district, and then what's our time coming up? I'm a little confused on. Our next election is 2 years from last year.
A year from this November.
This November, right. So, what kind of term are you working on?
Ms. Anthony?
Mr. Chair, I'm
sorry.
Mr. Barbosa, you would be working under the same time frame as would the county. So, I don't have that right
in the finger, just to do one of the handouts. Yeah. What about the census figures for the buildings as far as the school district is concerned?
Mr. Gross, would you like to follow up on when the census figures will be available for the school district?
The data that we are supposed to receive in March as we are told right now, we'll have a geographic code per school district. We won't have total information by school district, but we'll have geographic codes of precincts and block data by school district, so we should be able to aggregate the district, the school district. That is our full expectation, and that's what we are planning on doing. And that's based upon the latest geography we have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartles. Representative Mariani.
Yeah, I have a question for ourselves. The previous, I think it was the mayor's question about the student count, the college student count. Obviously, the count's been done already. So we're going to be working off of action that was taken last year during the census counting process. But it seems to me that it would be helpful for this committee as it goes through its redistricting process to be able to hear directly from communities like Winona in terms of things like, and it's sort of that catch-all communities of interest. It would seem to me it'd be important for us, and perhaps helpful for us, to hear from places like Winona things like where do the students reside. So, for instance, if you can make an argument that students per se constitute a community of interest within a legislative tract, that's probably information that will be helpful for us so that we can make more intelligent decisions about whether or not to draw a line that either encompasses all students, if you will, in Winona, or separates students, depending on what the patterns of living might be. So I just kind of toss it out there for us to think about. And I guess maybe just so I can ask a question for the chair, would that be the kind of thing that you would envision this committee entertaining as we go through the process, information directly from Winona about things like where do the students live, perhaps a cogent argument on their part that students constitute a community of interest, that we should keep that in mind? Would that be an appropriate thing for us to consider, an appropriate expectation of this community?
Representative Mariani, Absolutely. I mean, that's why we're here, to get the input from several students who are here. Maybe Representative Pulaski can comment about the trends that have occurred in Winona, or if not the mayor, perhaps, in terms of student population and where they reside.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Marianne. The last presidential election probably showed us the clusters of students more dramatically than anything else, and I noticed we have the county auditor here and others. We ran out of ballots in a couple of areas due to the number of new people who were voting in unanticipated numbers. Remember, we have St. Mary's University, we have Winona State University, and we have a technical college. Now, with St. Mary's and Winona State, we do have dormitories, and there is a high clustering of apartments. In fact, both Representative Seifert and Representative Paulson drove through part of that complex when we tried to find parking anywhere near Winona State, which is a constant issue that we'll bring up in another committee. Those problems continue to exist, and that's a problem for us in parking, but it's also a good thing, and those students do bring a vitality to the community in a number of ways. So those areas are there. The technical college is a little bit different. It does not have dormitories. So if there are students from the technical college who reside in Winona, it's probably through an apartment. But considering that that's a one-year or a two-year program, it's a little bit more volatile.
Representative Mariani.
Maybe to Mr. Gillespie on this issue. In terms of how fine the detail is that we get from the Census Bureau, would it tell us things like student demographics in a town? Will the information we get, in addition to age and household type, would it also give us information about college attendance or anything that might indicate to us where college students would live and reside in the community?
Mr. Gillespie?
Chair, Representative Mariani. The census data, unfortunately, the census data will be information on enrollment and higher education, things like that, from the census data. Unfortunately, it'll be another year and a half before we receive that data, and that will not be included in the data that we will receive from the initial release, which will merely give us the total population within very small units of geography and the population by race and ethnicity. We do have 90 census results, but I suspect that things have changed a little bit over the decade. There would be information also from the university too, in terms of their student enrollments, which might help reflect that community of interest. But I believe you would need outside information for that community.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if this was made specific, but just to answer the question that some of the school district and county commissioner folks might be thinking, the Secretary of State has the handout on the table about when you have to have redistricting done. And for municipal folks, does the city of Winona have precincts or at-large city councilmen or both?
We have.
Mr. Mayor, appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, too, we have two at-large and four wards. Four wards, two at-large, and mayor.
Okay.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, it says in our handout, and I think for all the local units of government, it has the Secretary of State's masthead at the top. This will be very helpful. And there's a little extra incentive for the mayor and councilman here that I'll get to, but municipal wards and precincts redistricting estimated data is given out. Wards and precincts must be redrawn within 60 days after legislative redistricting, or at least 19 weeks before the state primary, whichever occurs first. So basically, if we get legislative redistricting done on time, you've got the clock starts ticking, and you have 60 days to get those precinct boundaries redrawn. And it says in state law, and I'm not kidding, this might be something we need to repeal later, but it says in state law right now, if the governing body of the city fails to take action within the time required, no further compensation shall be paid to the mayor or the council member until the wards of the city are reconfirmed or redefined as required by law. So I guess you don't get a salary, which you probably just...
I'd be missing one. We'll make sure we do what we have to do, but I think what a lot of people are probably interested in is the political effects of redistricting, not only on the state level, but on the federal level, too. And the way that's gone about sure has an effect on all of you up there, one way or the other, probably more so. Well, just as much on us, because it affects, who represents us. I think that's maybe some of the questions that might be answered. And just to get back, I appreciate the emphasis on the student population, because that is important, especially in cities like Verona, Mankato, St. Cloud, other cities that have large population of students, and like I said before, they all demand the same or command the same services that everybody else does, and in some instances even more so. So thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Well, this is the open mic portion of the committee hearing, so feel free to come forward and give your advice. Here's somebody. Please identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Matt Bosworth. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Winona State University. And my particular expertise is in the law and courts. And first of all, I'd certainly like to thank the committee for being here, for coming. And I just want to give any advice that I might have regarding some of the legal issues here. Although I realize that probably no matter what you all do, you're probably going to end up sued. but hopefully that there shouldn't be too much of a legal problem. And Mr. Chair, you mentioned some of the traditional legal principles that have governed redistricting, such as compactness, contiguity, respect for political subdivisions, etc. And it does seem like that these are very important principles that the courts do look at quite strongly, although they also look at, again, things like shared interests, traditional boundaries, the principles that you're using, because it seems like that is something the courts do look quite strongly at. In other words, that it appears that there is a lot of flexibility, especially in terms of preserving subdivisions like Winona or Redmond, for example. But still, at the same time, the courts do like it if the principles are articulated ahead of time. So I was wondering if that's what you all planned on doing.
Thank you, Mr. Bosworth. Well, I know it's certainly my intention for the committee members to have some standards or principles as we move forward in the process. Absolutely. That's been the tradition in 1990, 1980, and I expect that's why we're getting the testimony now, getting public testimony, determine what those standards perhaps should be. So I expect we will move forward. For 1990, just so you know, it was plus or minus 2% in 1990. I think it might have been plus or minus 2% in 1980. Mr. Pender isn't with us today. It does vary state by state in terms of what the courts have allowed and disallowed. So, Mr. Representative Pulaski.
Chairman Paulson, to the point of his question, could you tell us whether we're going to see a bill moving forward or whether we're going to see a resolution? Now, we know there's a bill moving in the Senate. Is the House going to do this by bill, or are we going to do it by resolution?
Well, Representative Pulaski, my understanding is that Senator Pogemiller introduced a bill. They preliminary had some discussions on Monday without having any public testimony. I'm of the opinion that's absolutely the wrong way to go in terms of not having any public input and presenting a bill and perhaps pushing it through. So I'm hopeful that through this public testimony now, we'll have the opportunity to develop those principles, probably in a resolution as was done 10 years ago. It may be a joint resolution, maybe a concurrent resolution. If we do a bill, that would essentially make a law 10 years or longer, essentially, in the statutes, and so I'm not sure if that's in our interest or not, if that's the appropriate way to go.
All right, so just to the chairman's point, there is a bill on Senate side that you could have access to that may or may not contain the principles that will finally be agreed upon. More likely, it would seem that we will finally have some type of a resolution. will contain maybe those principles, but others also, maybe not as well.
And Representative Pawlowski, actually, 10 years ago, these standards actually were passed just days before the redistricting bill itself, actually. But you're absolutely right. And those standards are used in terms of court proceedings later. The courts look to what those principles are. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, again, to the question, you're right. In the past, it appeared that the resolution was passed rather late. As a matter of fact, it was passed probably at a point where it wasn't as beneficial as it might have been in terms of assisting the committee in putting together a redistricting plan. I guess I'm wondering what the time frame is. I know we've talked about this in previous meetings, that we do want to come up with a list of criteria, that we do want to do something similar to what the Senate is doing, either in terms of a resolution or a bill. And I guess I'm trying to get some sense of when that's going to happen and when it might be available, so that we can coordinate our efforts between the House and the Senate in arriving at a plan that hopefully will allow us to move forward without court action.
Well, Representative Gray, as I said, we'll likely have standards or principles sometimes in the next probably couple of months. We probably won't wait till 2 days prior to when the bill is passed. This was done 10 years ago. At that time, you know, two houses actually were controlled by the same party. I would expect that we would try and move forward earlier in a bipartisan, actually a tripartisan basis, if you consider that the governor is interested in this with his task force or his commission as well.
Mr. Chairman, so we shouldn't expect this for at least a month or two. Is that what I'm understanding? You're going to continue to have additional hearings on this, and it could be at least a month or two before we would have something in front of us that might be useful.
Well, Representative Gray, as long as we continue to get public input, I think that's the key element to making sure we have the standards that are workable. When the census data comes in as well, which we shall have, as Mr. Gillespie said, before April 1st, likely sometime in mid-March.
One final comment.
Representative Gray.
It might be helpful then if we at least present to folks who come out to these types of hearings what was done in the past and highlight that a little bit more, so that there's actually a document that they can provide input on, as opposed to, you know, what we've kind of done is just ask for comments, but not specific comments on criteria that might be used in the process, and to fine-tune the process a little bit such that we can actually get some useful information on a more timely basis might be helpful.
Well, I agree. In fact, in the Marshall hearing, we had some good comments on the deviation percentages themselves. And in my opening comments, we laid out pretty much what all the criteria have been or expect to be. So public comment is certainly important and welcome. Representative Pawlowski.
Just one more point of clarification dealing with Representative Gray's question. Will we have two resolutions, one for the congressional districts and one for the legislative, or will we have one resolution where we'll try to, except for deviation, that might be the only one that would be significantly different? So we're looking, previously, I think last time we had two, so we're looking at two with the exception of deviation, or are we looking at one, and we would go with whatever deviation we had for the congressional, we could apply that to the legislative.
Well, Representative Plosk, that's a good question. I hadn't given that much thought, actually. The congressional deviation, of course, is zero. And you could argue that the Minnesota Constitution requires us to apportion equally, redistrict equally, which hasn't been defined. That whether you take that to a 0% deviation or not, I'm not sure. So that's open for discussion again. Representative Seifert, did you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I think we need to have those discussions as time goes on. But I think it's important, since we have people here who are, and obviously the gentleman's in political science, perhaps what I've been looking for when we went to Brainerd and we went to Marshall was we did have a political science professor actually testify in Marshall as well on some observations that he had had. And he had been to several different states in the last 20 years, and I chatted with him afterwards about what he had thought. But what you might have in mind, would tighter deviation be something that it appears to me that you're pretty familiar with this process. Would you suggest a tighter deviation, or that we link congressional district with legislative district type things? And that's generally what I'm looking for when I have bills before us, it's nice to have folks give us their ideas and then cobble together things to reflect accordingly. But I didn't want to...
Mr. Bosworth, please, if you could provide that input, that'd be very helpful for all committee members. So.
Well, I should say that I don't really see my role here as an advocate, more as just trying to ask questions. But I think that in general, it does seem like that the courts have given you all more flexibility in terms of the state legislative districts, and the preserving traditional political boundaries can be very important. And again, such as Winona, such as Red Wing, and maybe trying to preserve communities of interest, such as the students, whenever possible. That there's no reason why you all should have to stick to a zero deviation at the state legislative level. If you think that there are reasons to move away from that, makes sense. I mean, just not to get too abstract here, but of course that these communities of interest are represented at the federal level quite well, with the states having, of course, much population deviation, and the Supreme Court doesn't seem to have too much trouble with that. So I hope that you all would take that, the traditional district, the traditional political communities into account.
Thank you very much. Are there any others, Representative Mariani, you have a question of Mr. Bosworth, or?
No,
just one more.
I'll wait for
okay. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and the tape.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnold, resident of Winona, Minnesota, and third ward councilman for Winona. What I have is a real broad question, and because I know redistricting is going to have a great impact on the overall power structure of the state, the Twin Cities area, and the surrounding suburban communities are going to gain seats, and that's going to center the power base more and more firmly in the Twin Cities. That's going to have, maybe if you can speak briefly to how that's going to impact outstate. How can we continue to maintain attention levels on things that are very important in our communities? Well, the voice is shifting more and more to Minneapolis. You know, we're 100 miles south, and for instance, when we hear about the Twin Stadium, it's going to cost. When that was an issue, I don't know that a lot of people in the community felt that they had a great input. And so I think maybe to summarize, the fear may be that Minneapolis and the suburban communities can get what they want, and we're going to be the third that has a hard time gaining voice.
Well, Mr. Arnold, thank you for your comments. I mean, that's of course the challenge, you know, for us. I mean, the realities of the population shifts, the demographic shifts over the last 10 years are what we have to take in account, keeping in spirit with the one person, one vote in the Supreme Court cases. I know, of course, as long as Representative Pawlowski and Representative Riffenberg are representing, you'll be more than adequately represented in St. Paul.
They've done a great job.
And maybe Mr. Gillespie can comment on what the population is of the 11-county metropolitan area versus the rest of the state, just so you get a snapshot of what the population breakdown is. That might be helpful.
You know, even though the population is changing, a lot of the same needs are still going to be there for us. And with the change in representation, it's going to be harder for us to get the attention that we need to get the funding for the projects that we have.
Mr. Gillespie.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the 11-county Twin City metropolitan area now encompasses more than half of the entire population of the state, and as I indicated, the suburban, particularly the newly emerging suburban area, is growing very rapidly. It's also growing outward and moving outward. Well, for example, and really beginning to have effects into Rice County, into Pine County, and towards St. Cloud I know that Steele County, Owatonna has talked about the 100-mile ring effect and is beginning to have some impact there too. So there is some impact that is spreading outward, but most of that growth is occurring in that donut ring around Twin Cities.
Representative Pawlowski, Mr. Chairman. Mr. West, can you just give us a ballpark percentage of not just the metropolitan area, but if you would factor in Rochester, St. Cloud, Duluth, if you put those in, what's the greater Minnesota versus then the metropolitan percentages?
Quick, do your math in your head there, Mr. Lester.
You said about 50. Are we looking at 60, 40, 65, 35? What are we looking at?
Chair, Representative Kowalski, the Leavenworth County area now represents more than 55% of the population.
So if we factor in Duluth, Rochester, St. Charles, or not St. St. Cloud, not St. Charles, although we'd like to, what would we be looking at there? What, 65%?
Chair, Representative Kowalski, I believe that would be a reasonable ballpark.
So if you're looking at the legislature, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kowalski, if you're looking at the legislature, then you're looking at a distinctly different legislature than the one we have now, with almost a 50-50 greater Minnesota metropolitan nature.
Mr. Kowalski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kowalski, that would be roughly speaking about two-thirds, but again, to a large extent, it depends on how the districts are drawn. And that would be just purely the population concentrations and how the districts are drawn makes a great deal of difference.
Representative Mr. Chair, Mr. Desi, I have just one question dealing with communities like Marshall that we were at last week and then Winona. If we went to zero deviation, is there the possibility of severely undercounting the legislative districts because of the student factoring, that as the mayor indicated in his testimony, that perhaps when the count was taken, it was taken at a time of the year when there may have been some students that for whatever reasons we couldn't count. Is that a possibility that there'd be undercounting in those districts?
Mr. Gillespie.
Chair, Representative Kowalski, I believe that studies have indicated that the fall enrollments tend to be higher than spring enrollments, so that there would be some variation over the year. The undercount rate is also potentially higher in areas around colleges. Every effort has been made to identify places where people might live, but there's always the possibility in sort of a traditional missing of people around colleges and universities that has occurred because of the difficulty in finding places where people might live.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kowalski, would the Secretary of State, would you have any idea that has occurred in the last cycle 10 years ago, or that's a possibility now? You had mentioned in Marshall that you had already gone to some national meetings on this. Is that a significant issue in communities such as the Marshalls and Winonas and the Mankatos?
Ms. Anthony?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kowalski, I am not the person from our office. That was actually the Secretary of State, so I'm not
able to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Arnold's question really goes into the heart of why we're here, I mean, to get citizen input, and, you know, it's tough. I mean, there have been, in fact, demographic and population changes, and Representative Tingelstad, who's not with us today, she has 15,000 more people in her district than she should have. And, you know, so again, you go to the one person, one vote requirements from the Supreme Court cases and what's required with our Constitution for redistricting. We have to keep with that spirit of one person, one vote. And I know that's tough, but that's why redistricting occurs every 10 years. Otherwise, as it was before the 60s, some districts had 100,000 people and some districts only had 10 or 15,000 people. What they did, instead of redistricting, they just add another district just to kind of keep everyone happy, placated, and until the Supreme Court challenges came, then it required the equal population for one person, one vote. Representative Gray, I'm sorry, you had a follow-up question? Mr. Arnold? Or
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. It's kind of unusual to hear the metropolitan area grouped together as one large voting block. If you spend any time at the legislature, you realize what the suburban areas do and what the cities do. Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul are often extremely different. And I find myself, in many cases, voting more often with rural members than I do with some of my suburban colleagues. So there is more of a dynamic in the metropolitan area than one mass metropolitan group with very different interests.
And I often find myself wanting some of our rural members more than the inner city members. It's definitely a mixed bag. So Representative Seifert.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to comment on that as well. And Representative Gray and I were ironically talking about this beforehand, that, you know, Minneapolis itself is actually, I think, going to lose a representative, I think. And when we kind of lump the area together and say the metro area, but actually I think Minneapolis will lose a seat, and maybe St. Paul will take a half a seat or something, or a seat, I'm not real sure, because we don't have the actual numbers yet. But it is kind of, I think when some of those issues come up that are kind of fun, like primary seatbelt enforcement, I see the gentleman at the testifying table, Representative Gray and I might vote together on issues like that, and the suburbs tend to vote differently. So it is, some of these issues actually go both ways, rural, metro, inner city, suburban.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Michelle, I was just going to say that my hope was that once the Minnesota Wild set up shop in St. Paul, that people would stop calling us Minneapolis, but I guess we got to have a winning season for that.
See, we have a school board member who came forward. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Fred Peterson. Aside from a rather obvious loose connection to state government, I also sit on the local school board. And just falling right in line with what Mr. Gray commented on, the donut power structure that's been referred to is pretty obvious. And that also is leading to kind of another situation that has a very profound effect on education, in that that same donut area is an area of fair affluence, a lot of young families, young people that are starting out with families and have a very strong interest in the investment in education. In other words, when school districts in those areas propose a levy override referendum, generally speaking, they're very happy to pass and approve those referendums. However, out here and in the inner city areas, we have a much more difficult time generating that local support for our schools. So I would hope that you're obviously aware of that, and that somewhere along the line, in order to create a more equitable situation for education for our rural area and inner city area students, that we're able to find a way to compensate for that. It is leading to some very broad inequities in education. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Mr. Chair, can I ask?
Representative Mariani.
Can I ask you a question, sir? As you're a school board member? What?
Yes, sir. I am on the school board.
Because I really don't know Winona. I'm assuming that there's one school district in Winona. Are there surrounding school districts to Winona that collaborate closely with the Winona school district? And again, I'm kind of asking questions sort of under the community of interest concept that, you know, for me, if there's a school district that's exchanging students and doing some highly collaborative work with another school district, I can entertain an argument that the geographic areas that they encompass would be a community of interest and probably should be in one legislative district. So I'm just trying to get a snapshot of what's it like here in Winona in terms of the school district itself and in relationship with surrounding school districts.
Mr. Peterson.
Good question. And our superintendent could probably give a better answer to that, but I can maybe make some generalities. Yes, Winona, pretty much most of Winona County is one individual school district. We do have surrounding smaller districts, and we probably don't have the communication and the interaction that we should have. However, what I'm seeing now is that because of some very broad economic problems, not just with our district, but districts throughout the state, we are developing a lot more communication among those school districts, all the school districts throughout the rural areas and in some cases inner city districts, and trying to form a much firmer coalition. So it's something that we've been remiss in the past on, but we are out of need developing those coalitions. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. Can I ask one more representative question? One of the things that we've seen in Minnesota, both in the urban core and in greater Minnesota, and even in rural communities, has been a pretty rapid growth of students of color in the K-12 system. What's the story here in Winona in regards to that?
Winona has a very rapidly expanding and increasing population of minorities. We have a very large Hmong population. We have Hispanics, Blacks. I can't name specific numbers, but that's a rapidly growing segment of our population, and again, creating some real challenges for us in ESL, or English as second language, population. So again, it's placing a financial burden that we're not getting compensated as we need to.
Thank you.
Any other comments from members of the audience? Advice or input on deviations or otherwise? Welcome. You can identify yourself to the table.
I'm Dave Goldman. I'm a county board person. And I'm wondering, on our county board, three of us up for election, two are not. What will cause the other two to be up for election? What deviation or change in population would be necessary to require all five commissioners to run on time? The same thing will apply to city council and school board. What causes an official that is not up for election to have to run again?
Mr. Stoltman, Ms. Anthony, is that something you can comment on?
Yeah, that is, Mr. Chair, that is a 5% up or down deviation with the state note. And unfortunately, the statute is not real clear. And there was an attorney general opinion, I believe in 1981, that we're going to probably requesting another one just because of the way the language is. There were several of us that had to read it like 5 times, and we were drawing pictures and so on. So right now it's 5%.
What does the 5% mean? 5% of the current district, or the proposed district, or the current population, or what's your
requirement? Ms. Anthony, is that something as well that's in your working groups that commissioners can contact you?
Yes,
you?
Yes, Mr. Chair. One of the things we will be tomorrow, actually, is our first participant working group, and Mike Torkelson, who is the, I believe he's the director of the Minnesota School Board Association, will be representing the School Board Association, and we will also be having county participants on there as well. But what I can, it is very complicated. Perhaps I can read some of this AG opinion if you would like me to. The nature of this issue may be demonstrated by assuming a hypothetical commissioner district number one in a county where the average 1980 population of all districts is 100 and the 1980 population of district one is 110. If we assume that as a result of redrawing district boundaries, 18 former residents of District 1 are placed in District 2, and 12 former residents of District 3 are placed in District 1, I'm telling you this is complicated, then the post-redistricting population of District 1 is 101. In this situation, the net change, so we're talking about the net change in population, in total population of District 1 is 6. Which is less than 5%, actually, and when this was written, it was 10% of the average population of all districts. And then it basically it says, however, it's clear that the boundary change affected a total of 30 people, 18 removed plus 12 added, which far exceeds 10% of average district population, thus the need for a new election in District 1. And it goes on. It's mathematically challenging is what this is. A math major I am not. I'm a So that might better explain it. It really is complicated to explain, but I will also offer that our webpage will talk a little bit about this. There doesn't appear to be a real number, a large number of counties that are going to have this issue. It's just going to be few and far between.
Real brief, I think Representative Seifert just wants to read from the statute, if he could, real quick.
Mr. Chairman, just to provide some additional information out of statutes 375.025, where it talks about county commissioner districts, it basically says when a county is redistricted, there shall be a new election of commissioners in all the districts at the next general election, except that if the change made in the boundaries of a district is less than 5% of the average of all districts of the county, the commissioner in office at the time of the redistricting shall serve for the full period for which elected. So if you had someone who was elected in the year 2000, their district did not change by more than 5%. If you take their district they have now, it isn't 5% different from the other, plus or minus, from the other county commissioner districts after the census. They can serve their four-year term. They get redistricted in with another commissioner, or if there's a greater deviation than they have to run. In Lyon County last time we had, the city of Marshall grew, the rest of the county did not, and so we had to have a pair of county commissioners face off against each other in the rural parts of Lyon County. So it'll be challenging, I think, for people to come up with these in certain cases, but in some counties, they don't. In Traverse County, you have less than 1,000 people per county commissioner. In other counties, you're going to have an enormous amount of people per, and Olmsted's a good example, the enormous amount of people per commissioner. So, good luck to you.
Thank you. Mr.
Chair, Ms. Anthony.
I did want to comment the statute that you just read. That's what I was reading the Attorney General's opinion on. That's a piece that our office feels is somewhat unclear. So we'll probably be going back to
you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Larry Lemonhagen. I'm the municipal supervisor of the Rochester Armstrong Planning Department. I have the privilege of serving as Rochester City Council and County Board in 1990 in the redistricting and development plans. I'm here obviously to learn tonight, but also to possibly bring out some issues that may be considered in the future of redistricting. Center. One of those issues is that the city of Rochester is a growing community, as you have all known and recognized, and its method of growing has been to rather conservative from the standards of boundary annexations. Okay? They've attempted to balance the needs with their townships or surrounding townships, so they've only taken in land when it's typically been brought to them. Doing so, that has created a significant problem to those that are redistricting, because we have a very irregular boundary that goes in and out and is not always clearly identified. In 1990, or in the early 90s when this was approached, the legislative committee, when they drew the legislative boundaries, they chose to follow city limits, but they also chose to round off the boundaries and actually to take in parts of the surrounding townships. In doing so, they created little pockets of land, et cetera, that would essentially require additional precinct to be created, because you would have more than one Senate representative or representative, for example. One of those concerns relates to the fact that these pockets are typically rather small. They only contain very few voters. When somebody runs or votes, there's a privacy issue here that is, I think, should be at least brought to attention. Sometimes it may be a single household. If that's possible in the future, that would be desirable to be avoided. The other issue that relates to this is that because the city of Rochester is growing at a rather rapid pace, the city, the lower boundaries are using the city boundaries. Well, it may have been clear in 1990 where that city boundary was because there were houses and a cornfield. But not too many years later, that cornfield was growing houses. And suddenly, those boundaries are going between houses and everything else, and at least in the definitions of state statutes, imply that they should be clearly visible. And it is very difficult to maintain that type of parameter in growing communities or changing communities such as Rochester and Minnesota County for consideration. And last but not least, I will touch on the 5% county issue. I believe there is a bill in front of the Senate and also the House. It is a noble thing to get down to as low as 5%. We will certainly strive for a minimum. One of our challenges, however, is if the legislature again creates these small pockets, it may be very difficult, if not impossible, for the county board to create a contiguous district. We have one township that has a very elongated boundary against the city of Rochester, and in order to maintain that, we had to go to those townships and ask for multiple precincts to be created to provide for that boundary. The township did not have to render that, those additional precincts, which the Secretary of State can also probably comment on, maintaining all those precincts and ballots and everything else that comes into elections as well. So the city did grow beyond what was probably a, prior to 1990, it was a low Senate district, and the township was included. In 1990, the target was 65,000 people. The city growing to above 70,000 meant that it had to be divided, split up, and that type of thing created these type of issues. I expect the same problems are going to be occurring when the legislature takes into account these boundaries, because number one, the city boundaries have not changed. They have continued to grow, but they're extremely erratic in their shapes and how they are treated with the future. There's any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Clemenang, for your input. My understanding is the Senate bill wouldn't do anything with county commissioner districts, to my knowledge. But Mr. Gillespie, maybe you can comment on the 1990s process with the Rochester situation. I know we've chatted briefly about that, and some of my Rochester colleagues have mentioned those issues as well. If there's anything you could shed some light on, perhaps, for everyone, that might be helpful.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, Rochester has long had quite an active annexation process, which creates changing boundaries. Now, Rochester, Olmsted County, is also growing in its population as well. There is one issue that perhaps we haven't really thought about yet in this discussion, is that the boundaries that the Census Bureau will show for the data will be based upon the boundaries as of January 1st, 2000. All subsequent annexations, detachments, and other boundary changes will not be reflected in the data themselves. So we might need to at least be aware if it looks like a boundary is going to run through potentially part of Olmsted or part of Rochester, we might want to look at some updated information and that can be provided with the updated boundary annexation with the updated annexation information and legal descriptions. But Rochester does present challenges because of the rapid pace of change that has occurred within the city boundaries.
That does bring me to a question. The boundaries of the city of Rochester, the Census Bureau is based, as you said, on January 1st, year 2000. Within 2000, there have been 385 to 400 households annexed to the city of Rochester with approximately 1,000 population. We haven't seen the numbers, but I'm just guessing that should that or not be included in the redistricting plan or not? we think it should, because it would be more accurately representing what is currently there, but not sure how to proceed on that one yet. So I don't know if you have advice about that issue as well.
Well, Mr. Clemenhang, we're getting your advice, so that's certainly an issue we need to consider. Mr. Gillespie, and maybe what happened 10 years ago? Did they adopt the 1990 beginning January 1st lines, or did they take that in consideration?
And Mr. Chair, the data that we'll receive and the data that we received 10 years ago, it will be at a block level, and by and large, will be small enough pieces of information that we'll be able to reflect the updated boundaries. There are a couple of issues. One is how this information is treated with respect to the congressional and legislative redistricting charge. And in this case, one question that arises is in terms of principles. There has been discussion of principle to avoid, where practical, division of counties and cities and townships. And in this case, there's some complexity with regard to the city. There's another issue in terms of the boundaries that the city itself needs to develop in terms of its own redistricting process, that the city will need to reflect the current boundaries as they exist. When you're doing the redistricting, that includes the updated changes, but what that will mean is that you'll have to identify the blocks that match up with the boundary. A third issue is for subsequent state purposes, for things such as transportation aids, local government aids, and so on and so forth. The population estimates that we do reflect updated boundary changes and the population impact of updated boundary changes. And one of the things that we will be working on is identifying those boundary changes for that purposes to submit to the Department of Revenue before July 1st. We may also be able to work with Mr. Mueller and others in the legislative GIS office to provide further information to the committees.
Any other comments from members of the audience at all? Wrap up. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Paul Grover. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Chairman Mullen and Mr. Craig for coming down, and we're certainly happy to have strong representation from Mullen County on your committee. I'm not trying to make some sort of a technical comment here, but an overall comment. Other people who've stood here again will often talk to you about some very, very specific concerns that are obviously of great, great concern to them. And we appreciate you coming to hear those. It would be a horrible shame that you go all over Minnesota and you hear all these things, and you get down to looking at boundary lines for the city of Rochester and the like in all parts of the state. It would be a horrible shame if tripartite government kind of threw up its hands and said, give it to the courts. And so I would like it to be part of the testimony tonight, at least personally. I hope that your work will result in a resolution, a bill, whatever, but signed by the governor as part of the normal operations of government in light of the people, and not simply sent over to the courts. And I thank you very much for the effort you're putting into it. I hope you can be able to have something done in good enough time so that time pressure doesn't suddenly at the end take over and everybody says, oh, well, why not just let the courts do it? Thank you.
Mr. Graf, thank you for those comments. I know I can speak for all committee members that we take the job very seriously. It comes along once every 10 years, and I believe only once in the last 90 years have the courts not been involved. So our challenge with tripartisan government is to make this work without the courts, and that's certainly my goal, I think the goal of every committee member,
I think the governor would feel the same way, as well as the Senate, and we're going to work our hardest to make sure in the end that no matter if you live in rural Minnesota, urban core, or suburban areas, that you're fairly represented under a fair plan that recognizes all the demographic shifts. That's the bottom line, and I think as we move towards that issue of fairness, that we'll be optimistically successful. Representative Mariani.
Just a comment to the gentleman's comment. I only recently learned about the Senate bill, the one by Senator Pogemiller, and so I haven't thought that through completely through, but it seems to me that one of the potential advantages, one of the upsides of setting our principles in a bill, in bill form, is that the bill won't be enacted unless eventually both houses agree to it and the governor signs it. And it seems to me that that ought to send, if that were to come to pass, and that ought to send a pretty strong message to our courts that there was a high-level meeting of the minds around which the eventual plan was structured. So it seems to me that there's an advantage there. I think similarly, Mr. Chair, and I'm pleased to hear of the Chair's desire to see a resolution or perhaps two resolutions here in the House. I think that if we do our work well enough in the process of putting together those resolutions in lieu of a bill, a resolution around the principles around which the redistricting plan will be put together, that if we do that in a way in which the governor is intimately involved in shaping that, then that too, I think, similarly would send a pretty strong message to the courts about the will of people as represented by their elected officials and not necessarily by their appointed officials. Having said all that, Mr. Chair, you're correct. We've almost always been in court, and one of the things we live with in a free society is that pretty much anyone can file a lawsuit. And it just takes one person with a good argument for standing. And I suspect that somewhere out there in the almost 5 million Minnesotans, there's probably at least one person that could make that case eventually. But certainly, I would echo the Chair's sentiments and hopes that that at the very least, we wind up with a plan that, even if it is in court, that the justices will be looking at a pretty strong, clear articulation from the governor in both the Senate and the House. But I thank you for your comments and take great heart that citizens are also interested in that too.
And I know we'd all like to see that in the end, when we pass this bill before the end of May, that signed by the governor, that the courts can take our plan and defend whatever lawsuits are challenged or put up against it. That's what we'd all like to see happen. As far as the bill goes, the joint resolution would be another possibility. The governor would sign a joint resolution as another possibility on principles. Well, thank you again very much for all members of the audience for attending and for committee members taking the time. I know there's another meeting that's going to take place at 7 o'clock. Committee members, I think, will stay around informally for a brief moment. Feel free to come up and chat or take a look at the maps. I think you'll find it of interest. And thanks again for coming.
I forgot that there was a 7 o'clock meeting.
I forgot there was a 7 o'clock meeting.